Golf Smarter Premium, number 478, published on March 3, 2015. The Joy of Putting. Yeah, right. With Jeff Ritter.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Jeff.
Fred, so good to be back, my friend.
Oh, it is so great to have you back. Man, I went through the list. This is the 12th appearance on the Golf Smarter Podcast for you.
Is it really?
Yeah. You've been showing up here, beating down my door. No, it's the other way around. I've been beating down your door to bring you back ever since like late 2010.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I've always had such a great time talking to you.
And, well, thank you.
I'm connecting with your listeners, and you know, we've had some big life changes the last couple of years, and it was great to you know, to get your email and you know, get that invitation to be back on the show.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's great to have you on because I feel like I get to brush up against greatness as close as I'm going to get.
Stop.
your brand is spectacular and just continues to grow. So let's just get started. What is going on with Make the Turn Challenge? You announced that it was coming up here on the podcast well over a year ago. And you gave us some hints to it, but now you're well into it, aren't you?
Well, yeah. You know, I remember that show, and one of the things I always tell people is that when you declare what you're going to do to the world, it not only helps you activate it, but it also makes you actually have to do it. so I remember putting it out on that show, going, "Gosh, I hope this whole thing can come together," and it really did in fantastic fashion. Because I think when we talked to you, I mean, I'd only filmed like a pilot episode, and
yep.
Golf just was interested, and it just turned out to be something that was way bigger and better than even I could have imagined. So basically, we filmed 50 video challenges in the areas of golf performance, mindset, fitness, and nutrition, which are really the four pillars of performance that. We like to coach at Make the Turn, what we now call MTT Performance. And we submitted them to Golf Digest. They put them out every single week on Tuesday. Mm. In fact, it's a challenge number four, last challenge of our series. So every single week, Fred, they not only put out a video on Golf Digest TV, it was actually pushed out by Condé Nast Magazine Group. Went to AOL, Yahoo, Huffington Post, you know, everywhere that Condé Nast Magazine would push out digital content, it went. And it really took off. And we found out that recently that it was the number one watched program on Golf Digest TV, if not for the whole year, at least for certain spots. The numbers were astronomical. And Golf Digest was really cool. They actually let me do a weekly blog in association with each one of the videos. So there's always that story behind the story. So the tip is, you know, about 1.5 to 3 minutes, or the challenge, I should say. But then if you wanted to learn more about, you know, my inside perspective on where it came from or what inspired me, you can actually go to golfdigest.com. There's a blog section called The Loop, and you can go ahead and read all about it. So it's archived at golfdigest.com. All you have to do is click video, search Make the Turn, and any of your listeners can go ahead and watch them all and enjoy them.
Well, listen, it's been almost 15 months since you were last on. Let's talk about some of the different challenges and explain what this actually means to people who've not heard about this yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as a coach, you know, a lot of times you're asked to create all these how-to tips or how-to videos. You know, this is how you stop slicing it. This is how you stop topping and whatnot. And, you know, I wanted to do something a little bit different, which really wasn't a perspective on how to do something. It was more of a more of a nudge or a push or a means of activating people to go out and try something new. So from a golf performance-based perspective, you know, we had drills associated with finding your perfect rhythm. From a mindset perspective, we had awareness exercises that we talked about in the past with the paper clips, which were designed to help you become more aware of when your attitude stinks, you know, and maybe that's going to help you on the golf course or off. For the nutrition challenges, one we had called Mind Over Menu, which was basically, you know, you get off the 18th hole and you go to the clubhouse and you're hungry and you're going to eat something. You know, what can you actually order on the menu, or what can you swap out on the menu to help you maintain your health goals, your weight loss goals, or, you know, things that are important to you that you sometimes fall off the rails with just because you're starving, you're craving those carbs and whatnot.
Yeah, right. Give me a load of fried food and some alcohol.
That's kind of what happens, because when people are on the course spread, they don't drink enough water.
Right.
They don't snack throughout their round. They get tired. They get thirsty. And all of a sudden they hit the clubhouse and it's like, man, how fast can I get a pitcher of beer and a mound of nachos? And I'm a guy, and I like watching sports and I like my occasional beer and I like my occasional, nachos and whatnot. But the thing is that people just, they set themselves up to fail where those experiences happen way too often, So we like to get people to, set aside a day or two, which is your cheat day, sort of on a Saturday or Sunday, that's your golf day and that's sort of what you want to do. Hey, that's fine. But, if you're active and you're out there and if you're traveling with your company or your, with your family or, you're just a busy guy or woman and, life gets in the way, we want to make sure that the choices that you're making don't get you spiraling down to the point where you're sluggish and you're unhappy and you're gaining weight and you have poor energy and you don't sleep well and you got inflammation and on and on and on. So, the challenge series was kind of using golf as a tool for positive activation in the game or out. And every lesson was designed to be there to help you learn something about yourself, to help you have more fun with the game, but also to really give you some tools that we think can really help your lifestyle in every endeavor, even when you're not on the golf course.
Well, that's part of the reason why I've always loved to talk to you, because it's not just swing mechanics with you.
No, it's not. And the thing is that with our brand, I'm sort of the chief ambassador behind the movement, so to speak. I conjured up the concept a few years ago, but everything that I do comes from me really just wanting to create a brand that keeps me on point and makes me want to be the best I can be. And I had a history in fitness, not as a coach, but as a participant, where my life was really transformed by some key people. So fitness became part of, my life and what I like to infuse into my coaching. Of course, I married, a nutrition coach, so the nutrition component, became part of my lifestyle. And then spent a lot of time with a fantastic friend of mine. His name's Chris Doris. He's a Fortune 100 and 500 leadership coach. He's worked with PGA Tour players and whatnot. And, all of these mindset topics that we've, gone over the years have come from Chris. So, make the term became, golf performance, which is my specialty, mindset, fitness, and nutrition. But we always like to say, however good you think you can be, we believe that through good coaching, maybe you can be even a little bit better. So we're all about raising the bar, increasing expectations, and then creating a strategy to take concepts that are inherently complex and make them simple and doable and sustainable and really get you excited about prospects for you on the golf course or off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's fabulous. So what is the future now that you've been doing this for 50 some odd 70 weeks?
Yeah. Well, it's exciting. So it's not the end of the line at all. So Golf Digest is really excited about the success of the series. And
oh, congratulations.
This first series, it was a hard one, Fred, because Golf Digest, they've never filmed 50 of anything for one program. If you go to Golf Digest TV, they have a lot of different really great series that they run, but a lot of them are 10 episodes or 15 episodes, and it's just it's a cost issue. It takes a lot of time.
Oh yeah, video's expensive.
It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of money. It's difficult to get locations for extended periods. So what I did is I said, hey, this is what I want to do. I know it's ambitious, but if I can pull it off, will you run it? And of course, they said yes. So this first one was sort of all on me. I hired the video crew. I wrote all the challenges. I secured all the locations. Was able to find some sponsors to help support what we did. So we kind of went big.
Wow.
And we were able to deliver. Yeah. So now Golf Digest, they're excited about talking about creating an offshoot of the video challenge series and doing something else that's still within the MTT genre. So it's all about building the brand and sort of being that lightning rod for personal activation. So that's the first thing, which is exciting. So I guess I got to get working on what's going to be next there. And then the other thing that you and I talked about was the fact that we recently became partners with the Golf Channel.
Whoa.
So the Golf Channel has decided to get into the golf instruction / growing the game business, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm. and they're not doing it by trying to create a standardized, you know, methodology on how to coach. But what they've done is they've identified some key coaches in some key locations throughout North America that they want to partner with, be in business with, and try and grow the game with. So coming Masters Week, people that watch Golf Channel programming are going to start seeing a rollout of a new initiative called Golf Channel Academy. And they had a show called Golf Channel Academy.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not a new initiative. That's been around for a while, right?
Yeah, that's the TV show. But the Golf Channel Academy now is the actual hands-on academy experience that people throughout North America can engage in. So right now, I think they've got about 40 locations by Masters Week. I think they're going to have about 50 locations. As you look globally, in the next 5 years, they're projected to do as high as 150 locations. But basically,
this isn't like an online initiative or an app initiative. This is a physical presence.
Absolutely.
Sign up and go to the academy itself.
That's right. You know, so basically,
that's a good brand to put the name on. That'll get a lot of interest.
Yeah. So basically, our MTT Performance Academy here in Pebble Beach is a Golf Channel Academy. So it is a brand within a brand concept. The Golf Channel is going to help us with marketing and distribution. We have a territory right now which hits most of Northern California. So people that are in our region are going to start learning more about MTT at Poppy Hills, learning more about our staff, and we're going to have the interest and support of the Golf Channel to be able to create a product that's honestly better than we could do with our own resources. You know, it takes a lot to do something really special, and the Golf Channel wants to do something special. So they're trying to help, you know, good coaches in great locations elevate their game, so to speak, with the Golf Channel and NBC-style resourcing. So it's a pretty bold move. There's a gentleman named Todd Wilson who's the CEO of Golf Channel Academy, and his sort of history in business comes from NASCAR. He's actually the CFO of NASCAR, and NASCAR operates within a brand strategy where franchises have territories throughout North America. So basically, we're doing the same thing with golf instruction here. So the great thing is that you know, what we're doing is just going to keep getting better. You'll start seeing me more involved with Golf Channel programming. I've already done a bunch of videos that have already appeared on shows like Lesson Team Live. I might have an opportunity here soon, hopefully, to host one of those programs. The Golf Channel is launching a new digital magazine this spring as well, and I was lucky enough to get the cover of that first digital issue. So
awesome.
Yeah,
it helps to be handsome.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, I've really been so fortunate to just get a great response from Golf Digest and Golf Channel. And, you know, it's kind of like the whole, you know, 20-year overnight success, Fred. I mean, I remember my first...
Sure. Life. You know, none of this would have happened if you didn't meet Kate.
Well, she will definitely tell you that for sure.
I'm going to tell you that too.
Every idea that I think is mine obviously comes from her. But, you know, my first article in Golf Digest was April of 2014. And, no, excuse me, April of 2000.
Yeah. Okay.
April of 2000 was my first article on Golf Digest. And it was just a little one pager. It was at the back of the magazine, you know. But,
What was it about?
It was a pitching story.
Of course, I knew you would remember. You always remember your first.
Yeah, it was a pitch. Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry.
It was a pitching story, mm-hmm. and it was just all about you know, being able to better control distance and rhythm and get some predictable length out of your shots inside of 100 yards. But, you know, I had worked as a coach for the Golf Digest schools about 2 years prior, and the thing is that, you know, when you work for the Golf Digest schools, it doesn't mean at all that you're going to get in Golf Digest magazine. That's just not how they do it, right? So you could work for the Golf Digest schools forever and never get in the magazine. But I really wanted to do that. So I had written like 40 story, you know, ideas down, you know, with a short paragraph, sentence or two on what the story was about. And I sent them to Golf Digest. And I didn't hear anything back, and then I called, and I didn't hear back, and then I said, hey, I'm going to come up and visit you guys, you know, knock on the door and, you know, poke around a little bit. So I went up there, And really just through, you know, persistence, I got him to cave and pick one. And that story went in. And of course, you know, when you get your first magazine story, you go out to, like, you know, the grocery store, and then you show up with no groceries, you know, at the checkout line, and you got like 20 magazines, you know, and the lady behind the checkout counter is like, oh, you know, would you happen to be in this magazine? And you're like, oh, yeah, maybe, I think so, possibly. And then you like flip to the back and you're like, there it is. But anyway, that was how the whole thing started. And, you know, I just kind of realized that, you know, you gotta be persistent. And just because someone says no, it doesn't mean that it's not good or valuable. So I never got discouraged when I sent something out and nothing came back. I just did it because I loved it, and I kept on spreading it around and making relationships. So it's really just kind of cool to, you know, talk about this with you and think back to the first story. And then, you know, back then, if you would have told me that, you know, later in my career, I'd be spending, you know, 50 consecutive weeks on golfdigest.com and be doing a series with the success that we did, and then have these other opportunities, and then, you know, moving to, you know, the Golf Channel and NBC. I mean, you know, I'm a lucky guy, and it's just so fun to be able to get up every day and do stuff like this. I mean, yeah. Right now, I mean, I'm working. I'm talking to Fred Green, you know, and I love it. You know, so I'm happy to be here, and, you know, hopefully we can, you know, give some awesome stuff to your listeners today and get them excited about, you know, everything.
Well, it's, you know, it's one thing to, you know, spend all that time, and you said you're lucky, and there's no question there's luck involved with this, but you know, it's the 10,000 hours thing too. You've worked very, very hard at it. And I'm sure that you're the envy of many golf instructors, but you have this innate sense of how to make it work. And a lot of people are just, you know, they're golf instructors and because they were good at golf when they were a kid, but they don't have the business sense or the marketing sense that you have. So congratulations again. I can't be more excited for you.
Well, you know, I was talking to, you know, one of my clients is, gentleman who works for Apple Computer, and I just had this amazing day. Fred, I got to tour Apple. Can you believe that? I got to go up there.
Come on, you're not even a geek. You're just a golf guy. Oh, man.
I'm just a golf guy. You know, but
I've been a stockholder.
I got to tour Apple, and you know, this gentleman and I have been friends for a few years, and he's just the kind of guy that, you know, some people are the early adopters. You know, they drink the Kool-Aid. They get exactly who you are and what you kind of stand for and what you're going for the moment that, you know, you start talking to him. You know, so he's all about everything that we do with our brand here. And, you know, we were having lunch, and, you know, he understands that it's a challenge to be in this kind of a business. It's a challenge to grow and to evolve and to develop and adapt. And, you know, we started, you know, talking about the hours put in and all the things that I've done, and I've driven my car cross country 15 times, Fred. You know, moving from you know, Arizona to Palm Springs, and then up to Northern California, then going out to New Jersey, and then working on Long Island, and back out to California. I mean, it's just back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, the thing is that sometimes, you know, when you're young, and I still think I'm young. I'm turning 43.
You are
43, but. But you know what I mean? When you're really young, you know, when you get out of college, you're like, hey, this is the way life is going to be. You know, I'm going to make a bunch of money. I'm going to live here. You know, and the thing is that, you know, life is a lot more challenging, and sometimes things don't happen the way you think they would. And, you know, the way that I thought it would happen, honestly, when I got that first article in Golf Digest, I thought that, well, you know, Jim Flick was in Golf Digest, and he was a hero of mine, and Peter Costas was in Golf Digest. I just figured that if you were in Golf Digest, then you were going to be the director of instruction at the world's greatest resort, and you were going to charge X for a lesson, and you would be jam-packed for months in advance, and hey, the world's your oyster. You're hitting golf balls, and you're making people happy. And, you know, the business changed a little bit, and all of a sudden, just because I had one story in Golf Digest, that didn't happen, you know. So you work and you push, and, you know, it's all about trying to find this tipping point, right? You know, it's like this bucket of beans, and it's like, I'm going to try and get this bucket of beans to grow one bean at a time, then hopefully one day it's just going to fall over, and then I'm going to have this, you know, this career that, you know, I've created in my head. And, you know, obviously it's a challenging road. So anyway, so this gentleman said to me, he said, And so why do you continue pushing the way you push? Why do you continue trying to be creative and innovative? And, you know, why are you trying to build this thing which is so big and so robust when maybe some of your counterparts are content, you know, just putting T's in the ground and, you know, teaching one person at a time and whatnot? And I said, you know what? I said, I realized not too long ago that I am a lucky person. And I realized that, you know, depending on, you know, how successful things are from day to day, I firmly believe that, you know, worst case scenario, I'll always be able to pay for my rent, right? So I'm not going to be homeless, right? Might not live in the house I'm going to live in, but I'm not going to be homeless. And I also believe that, you know, I've got friends in my life that I think will always support me no matter what. And I'm lucky to be married to a woman who takes care of me and cares for me dearly. So if I have all those things, right, then I really have everything that anyone would need. And if that's the case, then why in the world would I get up in the morning and not try for anything less than exactly what it is that I want, you know, out of my life and my career? You know, so it's all about just, you know, being authentic and going big and knowing that, you know, I got so many hours in a day like the next guy does, but, you know, why not just spend those hours kind of going for it, you know, as opposed to doing something less, you know? So that was my answer. And I think that's the thing that keeps me thinking big and, you know, trying to be bold and trying to create some things that are exciting.
You know, when people like you are growing up and you're loving golf and doing this thing, their vision of doing something great is on the tour. It doesn't sound like that was your thought ever. It sounds like the teaching part was always where you were headed.
Well,
I may be misreading this.
No, I mean, it was sort of by default. I mean, I grew up idolizing Jack Nicklaus. You know, Jack was my hero. I remember watching him win the 86 Masters and it just beside myself with excitement, you know, and then I would go out to the practice putting green. My dad was a club pro. So I was at the golf course every single day, you know, putting and chipping and pitching and playing golf. And, you know, Jim Furyk was a junior member at our club and on my high school golf team. In fact, I just reconnected with him down here at the AT&T for the first time in a long time. But,
Furyk?
But anyway, I mean, you want to be a tour pro, but the thing is that, you know, when you're in high school and you're hitting balls next to Jim Furyk and he is who he is and you are who you are, and it's just not quite lining up.
Yeah. Well, he wasn't the way he was in high school, the way he is in high school. And you had to be standing there going, how are you able to get the ball where it goes with that swing?
Well, it wasn't so much that. It was just that, I mean, he was playing in, you know, these AJGA tournaments, you know, so he was like a little mini tour pro. I mean, you know, where I grew up, I grew up in a small town. I grew up in Amish country, Pennsylvania, right? And in Lancaster, PA, you know, if you're going to play in a golf tournament, you know, you and your friends, you know, get in a car or someone who you know who's old enough to drive, they pick you up and you drive an hour at most. And then you play a municipal course and, you know, after you're done, you know, you get yourself a sandwich, you know, and a drink, and then you get in the car and you go back home and mom and dad say, hey, how'd you play? And you're like, oh, I shot whatever. You know, Jim Furyk was going to the airport and getting on airplanes and flying to places like Sea Island and Sawgrass and, you know, playing in these tournaments, which were like tour events, you know, and he was winning them. And I remember.
So that put a perspective on the whole thing for you of, well, I'm not in that league.
It was just a whole different thing. I mean, and he was, you know, I was a little bit undersized, you know, growing up. I mean, some people would say I'm undersized now, but I mean, when I was in high school, I mean, Fred, when I turned 16, Fred, I couldn't see over the steering wheel of the car that my parents bought me, you know, for my 16th birthday. They bought me a 1984 Subaru GL, which is no, pickup truck, you know, SUV monster.
No, it's no deep dish pizza. No.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, and I had my license, Fred, I had my license for 30 minutes and I wrecked my car. I blew out all four tires and I ripped off the bumper.
the bunker?
That's where I was going. You know, I mean, so, I mean, I had, you know, some challenges where, you know, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to grow. And, you know, your parents taking you to the doctor, your endocrinologist, and he's like, he's going to grow, don't worry about it. But anyway, so I had this Jim Furyk character who was full grown, you know, winning tournaments nationally, you know, hitting the ball.
Shaving,
yeah, hitting the ball. You know, I guess, you know, the gap just looked really, really wide. And, you know, I'd struggle with my game a little bit at the end of high school. And, but I was at the same time, I had such a strong desire to play great. And that's when you start reading books and watching videos and, you know, asking your parents for more golf lessons. My dad was a pro, but
yeah, that's what you were saying.
But, you know, we used to, you know, get in the car and drive to, you know, the best coach in town. And sometimes we would get on an airplane and we would travel out to a place like Scottsdale. And I would be lucky enough to have dad buy me a lesson from someone like a Jim Flick, you know. So, I mean, you know, I always had this strong desire to play well. And, you know, that's where I think you start reading about the how associated with the what. You know, most people, like, you know, Jim Furyk was always kind of able to make a move that gave him what he wanted. I'm not saying he didn't practice hard, but, you know, some people just have that natural sequence of motion that lets them hammer it. I mean, you know, the Ben Hogans and the Lee Trevinos, I mean, you know, they didn't start off, you know, hitting it like 30 handicappers. You know, there was something about them, you know, just like a kid can sometimes step up and hit a home run in baseball. I mean, they understood how to put the club head on the ball to create a certain feel and sound and, you know, kablam, you know what I mean? And they honed that over time. But, you know, for me, you know, it was kind of hit and miss. It was elusive. You know, I developed an attitude that, you know, if I wasn't going to be a great striker of the ball, then maybe I'll be a great putter and have a great bunker game and pitching game and have a good attitude. And, you know, I had to develop my ball striking skill over time. And I've always been a good player. And I think that most golfers would look at my ball striking and say, hey, it's pretty darn good. But there's a difference between the way Fred Couples hits it and the way Bubba Watson hits it, you know, and then the way that I hit it in high school. You know what I mean? There's just a difference, right? Mm-hmm. You start searching for, you know, hey, how do you do that? You know, what do I need to change to be like that? And I think that's for me where the spark came in coaching, is being able to take in some knowledge, to apply it, to learn, to make a difference not only for myself, but to make a difference for the people at the club. I gave my first lesson when I was 16.
Wow.
Just, you know, play golf with the members, you know, and you're better than they are. And they say, oh, hey, can you help me with this? And I just kind of, you know, made it a challenge to deliver a result. So I would say that my attitude towards the game splintered into more of a coaching path versus a playing path at a very, very young age. And there was a multitude of factors associated with that. But one was, you know, struggling with my own game. One was being a little bit undersized and falling behind the curve. And the other was hitting balls next to a guy like Jim Furyk every day and just seeing someone that was clearly better than you were. Hmm.
Your history, what you're doing, your initiative, all absolutely fascinating to me. And I'm so glad we got the update. But to what you said just a moment ago, well, hey, can you help me with this? Can we talk a little bit about putting?
Absolutely.
Good. So we all know, hopefully we all know, distance and direction, right? The most important part of that is distance. Most people think, you know, the beginners, I love talking to people who are just starting to play golf, and you ask them the question, distance and direction, and they, oh, direction, you got it, right? And then, but yeah, you put it 17 feet past the hole, but, right, versus putting it 12 inches outside the hole, but it's hole high, right? Yes. So I'm assuming this is correct. Distance and direction.
Yeah, distance, direction, and then green reading would be the
ooh,
big three.
Ooh, and green reading. Okay. So let's, I want to pick those apart for a minute. Yep. My game's gotten better. My putting's gotten worse.
Okay.
And so, and sometimes it's distance and sometimes it's direction. I feel like I'm a decent green reader. That I'm pretty good with. I mean, people are like, wow, that was a good read. But it's either coming up short or it's going just an inch or two just to the right or the left. It's nothing, you know, it's not consistent right or left. If it was, that would help, but it's not. Let's talk about this. The distance part. I need some distance drills.
Yeah. Well, I mean, distance, with any shot, I mean, it really comes down to, number one, the quality of your contact, right? So, I mean, if you're hitting the ball all over the putter face, you're not going to have any predictability in your distance. And then from there, it comes from, I would say at the start, understanding that the correlation between swing size and rhythm associated with getting the ball to roll a particular distance. You know, so for example, I had a junior golfer out here the other day, and his distance control was all over the place. You know, so we just started kind of going back to basics, saying, you know, in putting, we're trying to create a stroke. A way to imagine a stroke is to imagine a pendulum on a grandfather clock. And one of the things about a pendulum is that it swings back and through an even amount on both sides. So I just go ahead and I hold the putter between my fingers and I get it swinging back and forth, right? And as it's swinging back and forth, you know, I'll start creating a cadence. Sometimes I'll say 1-2, sometimes I'll say tick-tock, other times I'll say back through. But I'm trying to get this student, you know, whether it's a junior golfer or someone who is advanced in years and has played the game for a long time, to kind of get reconnected with a pendulum swing and a pendulum rhythm. And then what I'll do is I'll keep on making those audible sounds, 1-2, tick-tock, back through, but I'll start to shift the size the pendulum is swinging. You know, so I'll go 1-2, and I'll make the putter swing within a small arc, and then I'll go tick-tock, and I'll make it swing on a bigger arc, and I'll say back through, and I'll make it swing on a bigger arc yet. And the thing I'm trying to get across is that regardless of swing size, the rhythm is the constant. It's mm-hmm. always the same, right? Mm-hmm. So once we can do that, you know, we'll just try and make some strokes where, you know, I'll have the student putt a ball any distance they want. I'll say, go ahead and putt it, you know, about 10 feet. It doesn't really matter. They putt it 10 feet. And I want them to feel a stroke that's in rhythm. You know, 1-2, hold the finish, see how far the ball goes. And then I'll say, okay, now let's go ahead and putt the next ball one putter length longer than the first ball. Mm. So the only thing we're going to change is the size, but we're going to try and feel that same beat, that same rhythm. So we'll try and create these little rungs of a ladder that start close and then go farther away. And then once we do that, we might putt a ball a longer distance and then work the ladder back towards us. But it's all about just trying to get sort of tuned into, you know, what is going to produce distance A, B, C, so on and so forth. From there, what we might do is, you know, have them grab their phone and go ahead and find a free electronic metronome app. Right, there's a ton of them out there, right? Yeah. So you find an app, and then what we might do is we might go ahead and start at a very low beats per minute, like 50 beats a minute, right? So at a pace that you would never putt at. So you turn on this metronome, and you start hearing this beat, just like you would if you were, you know, playing a piano or, you know, in a guitar lesson with someone, right? Obviously, musicians, they have to play to a beat and a rhythm, and that's what makes a band sound, you know, enjoyable to listen to versus like a big train wreck. And what we'll have them do is start to hear this metronome beat, and then we'll start to try and roll putts where they match the backswing and follow-through to the beat of the metronome. And the reason I like to start at a very, very slow pace is, number one, so that they can match the beat easily, but also so that they can start to feel what it's like to be held back, you know what I mean, to be at an uncomfortably lethargic pace. From there, what we'll do is we'll take that metronome and we'll zip it up to a ridiculously high number, something well over 100 beats per minute. And now it's going, you know, tick, 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 tick. And now they have to match the beat of something that's really, really fast. And, of course, they feel like they're being pulled forward to an uncomfortable degree. And once they can do that, then we try and find a rhythm that's really comfortable for them somewhere between the slow and the fast. You know, let's say around, you know, 79, 80 beats a minute. Everyone's different, you know. If you look at golfers and their golf swings, if you think about a slow rhythm like a Larry Mize, you know, versus a fast rhythm like a Nick Price, I mean, everyone in their lives, they move and they talk and they act at different speeds. So the rhythm that's going to be perfect for you is something that's totally unique. But once you find that rhythm where you're like, hey, this feels good, now all of a sudden I'll have them putt, right, around the green to the beat of a metronome. And just like a musician would play guitar or play piano or play the drums to the beat of a metronome as well. So now they get really tuned into the fact that there's a size to a stroke, which should be relatively even, but there's definitely a rhythm that's unique to them that needs to be the constant or the glue between the short, the medium, and the long strokes.
And does the that rhythm, going very slow to very fast, does that also dictate how far the ball is going to go? I mean, like, if you're going really slowly,
yeah,
at
sure.
that 50 beats, is the ball going to generally, you're going to hit that harder, it's going to go farther, and then with a quick rhythm, it's going to be a shorter putt? Or are you always trying to find your rhythm for the distance?
Well, your rhythm is going to be constant, whether it's short, medium, or long, right? So that's the idea. But the thing is that when you change the size of the swing within that rhythm, obviously the overall speed is different, right?
Right. But staying at your comfort zone rhythm.
Exactly. So obviously,
okay, good.
If you're making a bigger stroke, right, the stroke's going to have to move faster to fit within that same beat, mm-hmm. right? You know, so obviously it's going to have an effect on distance. But, you know, most people when they're out there, Fred, it's just that they're not really working on anything. And that's the problem, right? So with putting, you know, when people come out and they say, you know, what's most important? I say, well, it's got to be the speed. Because as you pointed out, you know, you can miss it a few inches right or left, but then you can also miss it, you know, a number of feet short or long. And I found that even the worst aimers in the world, you know, if I show them where the hole is and I say, go ahead and roll me a putt, they don't putt it 90 degrees to the left. You know, they kind of aim in the vicinity. They might not read the green, but they're pointing in the general direction of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
But that same person, I've seen them putt it 15 feet past, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the error of 15 feet is a lot more to their detriment than, you know, even a foot or two right or left. So if you have good pace, and even reasonable aim, then you're going to be in good position to, you know, have a short second putt.
Right.
And all of a sudden you have a lot of two putts, you eliminate three putts, and you start, you know, shaving those strokes. The next thing that I teach after distance is how to read a green. Because if you don't know how to read a green, it doesn't do you any good to be able to start the ball on a straight line with proper path and face relationships. You know, so the third thing I actually teach is direction.
Oh, so you go to green. Oh, so green reading is second for you.
Yeah. So
wow.
If you think about it, you know, Dave Pells, who was my first boss, you know, did a lot of research and basically said the average golfer under reads putts by up to 75%. So, you know, imagine if you were in a cold weather climate. Let's say you live in Green Bay, Wisconsin, right? And you love golf. So every day you set up in front of your TV and you say, I'm going to make 100 perfect strokes in my putting track, right? And the putting track is designed to give you a reasonable path and face that would move the ball on your intended line. And let's say you do that for 6 straight months. So you hone this perfect stroke. Opening day, you go out to your home course. And on the very first putt, you underread the putt by 75%. The only way you can possibly make that putt is if you take your perfect stroke and you alter it to push the ball or pull the ball to a higher line by path or face manipulation. So basically, if you can't read a green, there's no point in even trying to create a reasonable path and face, because it's just going to be a big waste of time. Now, if, Fred, you can find the proper line through understanding how to read a green, and then you can roll the ball at a desired pace, now starting the ball on that line becomes the most important thing. And that's where spending some time training path and face and starting line would be really, really helpful. But I think that when people learn how to putt, they're always trying to create this perfect-looking stroke, when in reality, it all starts with creating a smooth roll and then being able to judge slope in a reasonable way so you know where to start the ball. And then from there, start honing those little nuances in path and face to close the deal.
Fabulous. Awesome. Thank you.
Hey,
it really helps. I'm going to get off the phone with you because I want to go start working on it.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, that's just my opinion, right?
No, but that's okay. I trust your opinion.
But that's, you know, I used to spend a lot of time working on my path and my face, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the more I focused on those things, the less putts I made, because I wasn't connected with putting a smooth, beautiful turf hugging roll on my golf ball. I wasn't connected with the challenge associated with solving the problem of judging slope and grain and all these things that make, you know, golf fun. You know, all I was focused on was, you know, what does my swing path look like? What does my putter face look like? And I was standing in these little devices all day long, just going back and forth and back and forth. And I would go out and I would hit the worst looking putt you've ever seen, you know, and that became really frustrating. So, you know, the way that I teach putting was really born a lot from my own frustration in putting and understanding that, you know, all great putters, they roll the ball nicely. The ball doesn't hop up in the air. It doesn't skid. It doesn't do all these weird things. You know, my balls, you know, I was spending all this time working on my stroke, you know, directional mechanics, and then I would putt these balls, you know, and they would roll towards the hole like a drunk lumbering down Main Street. And like, and that ball wants to go anywhere but the hole. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started to soften my hands on the grip and become less rigid with my mechanics and start to feel some rhythm and some flow that my ball started to behave the way that I wanted it to behave. You know, I was also a big fan of Ben Crenshaw. And if you've ever seen Ben Crenshaw roll a ball in person, I mean, it is a work of art, you know, what he does, just rolling a ball 10 feet across the grass, you know, and my ball wasn't doing that, you know. So it wasn't until I started focusing on rhythm and roll and just trying to make the ball behave in a more beautiful way that I started to make putts and get back into the joy of putting. And yeah, I've worked on path and face since, but it's never been my number one priority as it relates to making putts or enjoying putting. Now, if people have really bad path and face mechanics and they can't start the ball anywhere near their intended line, you know, do they need to work on it? Of course they do, right? But for me, that's number three. And in the years past, it used to be number one, and I gotten away from that.
Fabulous. Well, you gave us the name of the show today, too, The Joy of Putting.
I love it.
Listen, I got to make an announcement or two, and then we come back. I'm going to ask you for one tip, and I know what I'm going to ask you for, so hang tight. Can you do that?
Yep, you got it.
Boy, do I have some huge news for you that we received this morning from Apple. The Golf Smarter app has been approved and should be available in iTunes and the Apple App Store. Not exactly sure what that means, but if you search for Golf Smarter app, which is the full title, and it's not there, try again tomorrow. I'll make sure to put a direct link to the app in our show notes from today. And with this app, you can either download or listen directly to every Golf Smarter episode right in the app. No more syncing with iTunes, the Apple Podcast app, or any third-party app. I'm so excited about this because I just think that we now that members only is done and we're doing premium, I think things are getting better and it'll be easier for all of us. If you have any questions about it or comments or even suggestions, please, I ask again, email me. I will return your email. And I would also appreciate, can you take the short 5 multiple choice question survey that we have there on the website? It's going to help us define who's listening. Everything is either at golfsmarter.com or today's blog post at golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Libsyn is LIBSYN. golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Now, Jeff, thanks for your patience.
Yes.
You mentioned that your first published article was a piece on chipping.
It was.
How about sharing the tip from the article?
Well, it was all about, so one of the things I learned when I worked for Dave Pelz was that it's one game made up of many games, right? And the thing is that in golf, I mean, there's a lot of different attitudes that you have for different shots. And, you know, Dave would always say that you have a power game, which is basically how hard and how far can you hit the ball. And then you had a finesse game, which was hitting it short and soft. Then you had a putting game. And then you had a mental game. So all these games together, if you were fairly proficient, would lead up to having one, you know, great round of golf, possibly. And the thing about the finesse game is that the finesse game has different from the power game and the putting game. And the biggest difference that we talked about in this story was the disassociation between your hips and your shoulders that you would normally have in the windup and strike for a power-based golf shot. So basically, when you turn your shoulders back, right, and then you let your hips wind up in a power shot, there's a difference between those two, right? And then as you transition from the backswing into the downswing and that gap increases, you know, you generate a little bit more ability to create a massive swat into the back of the golf ball, right? So being that in a finesse shot, it's more of a rhythm-based swing, we try to eliminate some of this disassociation as a means of taking away some of that explosive power. So basically the tip that I wrote for Golf Digest back in April of 2000 was a direct ripoff from my time at the Dave Pell Short Game School. So Dave, if you're listening to this, you get full credit for this and a lot of other stuff that I've written. But anyway, basically it was all about when you turn back and then you turn through, we're trying to keep the upper and lower halves of your body moving more in unison, right? So as I turn my chest away from the target, I would want my belt buckle to turn away reasonably to a similar degree. And as I was turning into impact into the follow through, I was trying to feel like those two parts of my body were staying more together. And that's what Dave used to call a finesse turn. So basically, like putting is stroke size and rhythm. With pitching, we would try and make it swing size, rhythm, and then, of course, club selection. We would try and eliminate the component of trying to disassociate, right, the shoulders from the hips to create that powerful X-factor style wind-up and delivery that you might have with a big driver, a powerful shot from the fairway.